Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit go.vikingcapllc.com/best. That's go.vikingcapllc.com/best to get started today. Did you know that within a decade, women will hold $30 trillion in investable assets? Yet somehow, only 19% of women reported feeling confident in selecting investments that align with their long-term goals. Our friends at InvestHer are out to change that. InvestHerCon is the number one premier conference for women in real estate, and it's happening June 2nd through the 4th in Austin, Texas. InvestHerCon is not just another real estate conference. It's a transformational experience focused on real estate investing, business strategies, and self-care tactics, all designed to help women take control of their financial futures. Gain the knowledge and skills you need to grow your portfolio and build a sustainable business, all while connecting with over 500 women who are playing at the same level. To learn more and to get your tickets, visit InvestHerCon.com today and use the code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. That's InvestHer, HERCon.com, promo code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket.
With one investor, it is less work on my end, but it's not a whole lot of less work after the deal closes.
Before we get into today's episode, I want to mention today's best ever partner and give you a free gift. And that partner is Fund That Flip, and they're going to be giving you a free deal analysis spreadsheet. You know who Fund That Flip is, don't you? Because you're a loyal best ever listener. They've been a sponsor on the show. Matt Rodak, the founder of Fund That Flip, has been on the podcast multiple times, given us his insight on the online lending process. Fund That Flip provides fast, reliable funding for your house flip projects. They're an online platform, makes the application process entirely easy, and they've got a whole bunch of experts on their team who can help you get funding in 24 hours and close within as few as 7 days. And all of you best ever listeners, you're getting a free spreadsheet to help you analyze your projects. Go to fundthatflip.com/best ever. That's fundthatflip.com/best ever. And you'll get a free deal analysis tool. It'll help you provide a scope of work for your projects, create the scope of work, analyze the profitability of the project, or if it's not profitable, you need to know that too, and make a determination on the max purchase price. Super important. You can print out all the detailed reports, and that will help you get your deals funded faster. Go to fundthatflip.com/best ever. Get that free analysis tool, fundthatflip.com/best ever.
Best ever listeners, how you doing? Welcome to the best real estate investing advice ever show. I'm Joe Fairless. This is the world's longest running daily real estate podcast. We don't get into any fluffy stuff. We only talk about the best advice that moves your real estate investing business forward. Today is Friday. Therefore, we're going to do an episode of Follow Along Friday. I am joined by Theo Hicks and my dog and Colleen's dog, Jack. How you doing, Theo?
Doing good, Joe. Doing good.
How you doing, Jack?
Scruffles is doing good, too.
Theo nicknamed our dog Scruffles. Actually, every dog
Every dog is Scruffles.
Every dog is Scruffles. By the way, best ever listeners, if you're joining us via the podcast, then what you've noticed recently is that we're doing Follow Along Friday live from my office, and you can always listen and watch Follow Along Friday on Monday at 10:15 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/meetjoefairless. And then that video is uploaded on our YouTube channel shortly thereafter on Monday. So with that being said, we'll dive right in. Today we're going to be focused on what we usually are focused on, our entrepreneurial endeavors, what happened over the last week or so. Mm-hmm. And then we're also going to talk about some questions that were emailed to us about multifamily syndication from someone who is getting started in multifamily syndication and had some questions. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be answering those questions. So, Theo, how do you want to kick it off?
Well, do you want to start with, we've got a little new addition today of a blank board.
Oh, yes.
And our first podcast was, our first live podcast was talking about that. So I know you've got this end of the month. Mm-hmm. Things are changing up a little bit. So you want to just briefly kind of touch on the idea behind end of the month on your board?
Yes. For anyone listening, you can visualize this very easily. There's a blank board behind us, a blank whiteboard. I have a couple whiteboards in my office, and one of them has 2017 goals, and then another has some shorter term goals that are projects that I want to accomplish. And then the other whiteboard has the monthly goals that I'm focused on for that month. And right now is the monthly goal board is blank. Mm-hmm. Because it's at the end of the month and I accomplished some things and I didn't accomplish others. And I'll be happy to talk through those. From a macro level, this was the most successful business month in my life by far.
Awesome.
And the main reason is because we closed late last month, so I'm kind of grouping it into this month, late last month on a 200 unit in Dallas. And then on top of that, we have two properties that are under contract, over 500 units combined in Dallas. And I have already secured the equity for those two properties. And it is over $11 million worth of equity that I've secured from a private high net worth investor. And typically, if I don't secure it from one high net worth investor, then I'll go out to my network of investors who I work with and have a good relationship with. And there are more individuals. And this actually brings up a question that is commonly asked, mm-hmm. but isn't something that was emailed to us, but I just hear it often. In fact, I answered this question for one of my investors just last week, and that is, would you rather have one investor or would you rather have multiple investors in your deal? And to me, it's a toss-up because with one investor, it is less work on my end, but it's not a whole lot of less work after the deal closes because how I do ongoing communication is via MailChimp. So it's just typing an email, regardless if it's to one person or multiple people,
yeah.
and then I send it out. So that's the same amount of work. And then accounting at the end, it's multiple K-1s versus one K-1, and our accountant does that. So really, other than after we close, it's about the same amount of work when you have, say, 50 investors versus one investor, as long as the project is going according to plan. If the project is not going according to plan, then I imagine you'll have a lot of investors asking you questions. Therefore, that's a lot of extra time that mm-hmm. it will take to field those questions, as they should ask questions if it's not going according to plan. But assuming that the project does go according to plan, then it really is a toss-up because when you have multiple investors, you also get more word-of-mouth referrals.
Mm.
And through more word-of-mouth referrals, your private investor network grows, again, assuming that you're doing a phenomenal job. But the same could be argued with the one high-net-worth investor. If and when you excel in that project, then they might be inclined to refer you to others, and their others are likely going to be at or around the same level as they are. Therefore, that one referral might equal a lot more equity than 50 referrals from other investors. It really, to me, I am indifferent towards one investor versus a lot of investors because I think it's a toss-up. But it is nice to have a mix. And the reason why I say this is the most successful month in my business is because I have a nice mix of, we just had a project, this 200 unit that we closed last month, and there were multiple investors versus this project where there will be one investor and his family. Plus, it's the largest equity raise that I've been involved in. $11.5 million equity raise is the largest I've been involved in personally, or responsible for, okay. I should say, for bringing. And any questions about that? I can see you thinking.
Well, I was going to ask about if we've got multiple investors versus just the singular investor. And I guess this would kind of question me based off your experience. This month, you said that you've got these two deals lined up and all the equity is completely raised. Is that standard for most deals, that you'll have all the equity raised before you actually close on the deal?
Yeah.
Does that happen every single time?
Before we close on a deal, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, we'll always have the equity secured and deposited before we close. Okay. And there might be a circumstance where we can close on a deal, but perhaps an investor with a self-directed IRA wasn't able to transfer accounts, or maybe someone had a life circumstance come up who thought they would be investing but were not able to, or an investor at $1 million was needing to decrease it to $500,000 at the last minute. And in those cases, we will likely have the funds to close and will continue to raise a little bit after to cover the difference. And the reason why we would be able to close in that unique situation is because we only need a certain amount to close with the lender and to actually close the deal, but then we have an operating account that we need afterwards. We have reserves that we'll need to have a certain amount. We'll need, if we are bringing all of the equity for renovations up front, then we'll need the renovation dollars if it's not a bridge loan or something where we're getting future funding. So technically, on all of our deals, we could close without completing the raise, but it's not a best practice, and it's not something that we do typically, although that has come up in one situation where we had some unique scenarios, and it's actually the last deal, and we had to close it out a little bit after because of some things with a couple investors who committed but weren't able to actually invest.
Okay, so all the money's raised regardless if it's one person or 10 people investing. So I guess the question is, in my mind, it seems kind of obvious what the answer is, but I'm just curious, based on your experience, how much more effective and, I guess, more smooth is the money-raising process when you have just one person? It's like, I'll do it. Like, all right, cool. Then you're just done. Versus having to do maybe 10 people who aren't all coming at once, and maybe you're at the last minute, you need one more person to come in. I guess, like, from a psychological standpoint, when you're maybe anxious or stressed out when it's getting towards the end, is it easier just to have one person do it all versus having to kind of scramble to get multiple people together? Or is that something you don't even face?
Well, it is something that at this point, if there's a gap, then we already invest at least $100,000 of our own money in the deals.
Okay.
Every deal, at least $100,000.
Okay.
And if there is a gap larger than that, we might cover it. We, meaning my business partner and I, might cover it. That's number one. Number two is, yes, and it goes back to, there's certainly a different time commitment. That's what I was saying. Before the deal closes, there's a different time commitment versus one investor versus multiple. But after the deal closes, it's a toss-up.
The toss-up, okay.
Yeah, but leading up to the closing and having 50 different conversations versus one conversation, absolutely, that's a different time commitment. But then the positive of having 50 investors versus one is you've got the positive word of mouth. So you do more work up front, but you have perhaps higher upside potential on referrals afterwards. And then vice versa, less work, but perhaps fewer referrals. But then, I was mentioning earlier, perhaps that one referral that high net worth investor has might be another individual like him or her, and that might be worth the 50 referrals that you got from the larger group.
Okay.
You never know.
Okay. So from your perspective, you're kind of indifferent to it, but since you're kind of experienced, what would you recommend to the newer investor? Would you have them approach it as just get as many investors as you can, or do you have them approach it as find one person up front?
I would have a newer investor approach it to just get the deal done. Whatever it takes, whether it's one investor or multiple investors, whatever you can do to add value to whomever's lives to get the deal done, doesn't matter. Okay. Don't have a strategy on one versus many. Just have a strategy to get the equity raised. Yeah.
Okay. I guess that was just macro level, but more detailed why, because we're all about consistent daily action. For the board, you know, I know the people that are watching it can't see it because it's blank, and the people that are listening obviously can't see it either. But before you had the different categories set up and the check marks and the boxes, and that was the first time you did that. So the first time you did the check mark board, best business month ever. Any relationship between the two? Did doing this add value to your business in any way? And if so,
yeah, absolutely. And best ever listeners and everyone watching, next week, because it will be in February, you'll see my February goals and you'll see how I break those out. Because I did learn a couple things on the goal tracker. And by the way, this was the first time I had this in this office, but I've done this before when I lived in New York City. And I had my own room. It's so strange. Living in New York City, you have your own room. When I moved to Cincinnati, I lived with my girlfriend, now fiance, Colleen. And Emily was a small apartment that we were renting before we moved into a house that we bought. So I didn't want to plaster my goal sheets up on our wall.
You want to freak her out too early?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I did this when I had my own room living in East Village in New York City. I had the same exact thing up and it was great. So done it before. What I've learned is when I have a vision board that is a poster on the wall, and when you lose sight of where you're headed, you can just look right up here and identify what you should be focused on. And here's an example. Last night, Colleen and I were talking, and she asked, what should my February goals be? Mm. And instead of saying, I think your goals should be XYZ, all I asked was, what are your 2017 goals? And she said what her 2017 goal was. And then I was like, well, I think it should be something that tracks to that 2017 goal. And I won't use her example because those are her goals, but one example for best ever listeners might be, if your goal is to wholesale 10 houses a month by December of 2017, then if you're wholesaling 2 houses a month now, then what I would do is I would identify what are the lead generation methods that you're getting the houses, and what are the lead generation methods that you're getting the buyers, and make it a point to do those things consistently every week and have some sort of check mark process to do. Yeah. And so that is how I approach the whiteboard and my monthly goals. And as far as just to close the loop on other things that made this the most successful month ever from a business standpoint, it was the largest equity raise, 11.5, that I've done. And by the way, we haven't closed yet. We close next month. Okay. So if something unforeseen or that we're not anticipating happens this month, something in the due diligence process, environmental issue, something, then the deals aren't happening.
Okay.
So I'm not counting my chickens before they hatch. I'm just simply saying where I'm at right now. So that's number one. But additionally, what happened this month is January is actually the most amount of downloads that this podcast has had. We're averaging over 6,000 a day. Mm. So there are over 6,000 best ever listeners every single day listening to the show.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And this time last year, because I track this every month, this time last year there were 3,000. It is doubled from this time last year. And the thing I'm curious about, and we'll see, is this time a year from now, will it have doubled or will it have gone up by 3,000? We'll go to 9,000 or we'll go to 12,000, and we'll see. But combine that with on the whiteboard, and best of listeners, you can always go back and look at the videos from our last couple of weeks. You can see the actual whiteboard if you want to. But on there is also have a magical moment with Colleen, and the magical moment terminology comes from being a Tony Robbins student. And that magical moment was going to a Dashboard Confessional concert.
Yes, yeah, it was awesome.
And here in Cincinnati, which was interesting. It felt like she and I have been going out for, like, 2 years almost. Almost okay. 2 years. And it felt like one of our first dates is just really fun doing something like that. And so it was by far the most successful professionally. And then also personally, it was a lot of fun.
Awesome. That's cool. That's awesome hearing that you've doubled your downloads in a year. We have doubled the best ever downloads in a year.
Yes, you are part of it.
And just from your perspective, 3 years ago, raising $0 to $11.5 million a month, it's pretty amazing. So that's awesome.
Yep.
Cool. So maybe next week when we see this up here, we can maybe talk about the board a little bit more, doing a dive into these, two questions.
So these are questions from a best ever listener from Madison, Wisconsin.
Yep.
First name's Tim. I won't say last name for privacy reasons.
And it's hard to pronounce anyways.
Wow. And he is asking, I'll let you set the stage.
So he says that he's starting on the path of multifamily syndication. He's actually going to be closing on a 100 unit in a few days from when he sent this email. He says he's made some connection. He's working with a great property management company who is managing several hundred units. And I guess through their relationship, through conversations, it's kind of organically grown into more of a partnership and less of a employee-employer relationship. And so he's got two questions on how to structure this syndication deal, or just syndication deals in general, since it's his first one. And the first question he has is, what do you typically do for the loan guarantor? Do you personally guarantee the loan, or do all investors take part in the loan guarantee? So Joe, do you want to, I guess, first set the context for what he's actually talking about and then answer his question?
Yep. Context for what he's talking about is when we get any loan, whether it's single family or multifamily or commercial, there needs to be some sort of accountability for borrowing the money from the lender, and the lender wants a guarantee from the individual or entity that is borrowing the money, unless it is what's called a non-recourse loan, which means that the lender cannot go after you as a borrower unless, and there's a couple disclaimers. One is they call them bad boy carve-outs. Unless the bad boy carve-outs or clauses are triggered, and a couple bad boy carve-outs or clauses would be gross negligence. Okay. So if the borrower just completely forsakes the property, pieces out, goes to another country and abandons it, then they can make the loan recourse, even though it's non-recourse, or fraud. If you're doing something illegal and you are caught doing the illegal activity, then the non-recourse can become recourse. And there are other technical things that make it a non-recourse recourse, but the reality is those are the two big ones that you'll hear about and that are probably triggered the most. But what Tim is asking about is, what do you typically do for the loan guarantor? So that question implies that he is not the loan guarantor, that he brings someone else in, and it's different if it's recourse versus non-recourse.
Okay.
Because if it's recourse, meaning they can go after the loan guarantor, and why you have a loan guarantor is you don't have the liquidity and or net worth to qualify for the loan. That's a problem I had whenever I got started, and that's a problem that 95% of people have when they get started, is they don't have the money in their bank post-funding to qualify for the liquidity and net worth requirement that the lender has. So what do you typically do for the loan guarantor? Well, if it's recourse, then you're going to give them more. If it's non-recourse, you're going to give them less, because non-recourse, they have limited liability unless you neglect the property, yeah, gross neglect, or you commit fraud. So what we have done with our loan guarantors is we have given them equity in the general partnership, and or, depending on the deal, we have also given them a fee that's paid out on an annual basis based on the amount of the loan at that point in time.
Okay.
And that fee specifically, Tim, on a non-recourse loan is 0.25%. So let's just use round numbers. If it's $1 million loan balance, and if they signed it as a guarantor on a non-recourse loan, then 1% of $1 million is 10 grand, and so it'd be $2,500 a year that the loan guarantor would pay. And so multiply that, if it's a $10 million loan, then it'd be $25,000 that they would receive every year for signing their name on the loan documents. In addition, they might get equity in the deal. And this depends on you and how you negotiate, what the projected returns are for the deal, and how much you want to get the deal done, and how many other options you have to guarantee the loan. It could be any number of percentages from 5% to 10% to whatever. It just depends. Now, that is with a non-recourse loan. We do not have any recourse loans. Therefore, I don't have any personal experience working with someone on a recourse basis. I can tell you, though, just common sense is whatever I just said, probably double it at least.
Okay.
Because if they're personally guaranteeing it, then there's more risk should something go wrong. And you'll just have to talk to them about what they're looking for. And I've told people about this approach and what you compensate a loan guarantor. And some people are like, wow, $25,000 for writing your name and submitting your financials on a non-recourse loan of $10 million, get $25,000 a year. That's amazing. Yes, but think about what they're risking, even though it's non-recourse and it's a very remote possibility. But think about what they're risking $10 million potentially in return, which is $25,000 a year. I mean, risking
0.25%.
Yeah, but on a $10 million loan, that's $25,000 a year.
Yeah.
I would do it if I didn't do the syndications. I would be a loan guarantor, but I'd have to make sure I know the individuals really well, and I'd have to look at it on a project-by-project basis, because I do think it's a very good deal for high-net-worth investors or individuals to do a loan guarantee on a non-recourse loan and get free equity and also get free cash flow. When I say free, I mean you're exchanging your balance sheet for this, but at the same time, there is risk involved, as with anything that we do in real estate, and I would look at it on a project-by-project basis. But it certainly is appealing to high-net-worth individuals, Tim, and the rest of the Best Ever listeners, and those are specific ways that you compensate them.
Would there be a situation where someone that was investing in the deal was also the loan guarantor?
Yeah, we have. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, that's exactly what we do.
Okay.
We have had investors who invest in the deal as a limited partner also be on the general partnership side as a loan guarantor with us.
Okay. And then, you kind of answered this, but would you ever in the future personally guarantee your own loan that you raise money for, or would you?
Oh, we do.
Okay.
In addition, yes, we also sign on the loan in addition to the investor who has the balance sheet to get approved for a sizable loan.
Okay. But there are clarifying questions, because I personally don't know a lot about this. Maybe other people don't either, but it doesn't have to be one person. It can be like this person. You need $1 million. This person right here has got 250. This person's got 300. This person's got 450. Seem to three different people, or does it all have to be one individual?
It could be a combo.
Okay.
In this case, definitely the fewer the people, the better.
Okay.
Because of financials and legal paperwork, and it gets messy. It's a lot of stuff to go through. So I would keep it to one if possible, but it can be a combination.
Okay. I think we adequately answered that question.
Cool.
In the short term, it depends because of all the different things that you explained. So the second question is about equity percentage. So what equity percentage do you typically take for organizing and putting the deal together? So the acquisition fee.
Mm-hmm. Well,
is that what that is?
No. He's asking about the equity that we get in the deal, not necessarily the acquisition fee. Acquisition fee is the fee up front that's paid. Okay. He's wondering how much equity do we actually have in the deal.
Okay.
And the answer to that question, Tim, is it depends on you and your investors. I'll tell you what we do. Again, it depends on the deal, but so far we have done 8% preferred return and a 70-30 split. 70% to limited partners, 30% to general partners. So the 8% preferred return, that is 8% paid to investors on their investment dollars first, and then after that, profits are split 70-30 on the cash flow. It varies greatly from the syndicator or sponsor to their experience level to the project. Because I see tons of deals come across my desk. I've seen 12% preferred return on deals and a 50-50 split on development deals because the development deals have higher risk than what we do. We buy stabilized apartment communities that have value-add components, whereas development deals, they're on the riskier side but higher potential for reward. Therefore, the developers, when I first got started, I could never understand how they were able to offer a higher preferred return on something that doesn't exist when we do 8%. Well, how they're able to do that is they simply don't pay out the 12% preferred return in the first 2 years while it's being constructed and leased up. And the 12% is accrued to years three after it's stabilized, and then their investors, in theory, receive the windfall of everything that they have been accruing. And then after that, it's a 50-50 split. Mm-hmm. And then I've seen on deals 5% preferred return and 80-20. 80% limited partnership, 20% general partnership. And those are on Class A apartment communities. Or they're simply with an operator who wants to have more cash flow from the preferred return because the preferred return hurdle is less, so he or she will receive more cash flow even though it's 80-20. It just depends on how you want to structure it. You're only limited by your creativity and what the market will command and what your investors' goals are. So what I would do for anyone starting out or for you, Tim, who is closing on your 100 unit, congratulations, by the way, on that 100 unit that you're closing on. What I would do is I would identify where are you at in your business evolution. And most likely, it sounds like you're at the beginning. Therefore, is cash flow more important to you than money in 5 years? Mm. If it is, then perhaps have an acquisition fee that is 3% and a smaller equity split on the back end. So what industry standard is on acquisition fee, which is the fee you get paid at closing, is anywhere between 1 to, I've heard Dave Lindahl talk about 5%, 1 to 5%. We charge 2%. Maybe do 3% acquisition fee to get cash flow up front for your business, but then have a 8% preferred return and maybe 85-15 equity split with investors. That way, you get paid a little bit more up front to help with your cash flow as you build your business, but you don't get as much later, and it balances out what the fees are because you're giving them more equity in the deal, but you're taking a little bit more at the beginning if you're looking to build your business and you need cash flow. And then vice versa, as you continue to grow your business, then less of an acquisition fee, maybe down to 2.5% or even 2% what we do, but do a 60-40 split with investors or 65-35, 70-30 split, or even have performance hurdles. We do performance hurdles in most of our deals where it's a 8% preferred return, 70-30 split, But then if and when we reach a certain internal rate of return to investors, then maybe it's 60-40. And then if we reach another internal rate of return to investors upon disposition, then it's 55-45 or 50-50.
Are these splits, these 70-30 splits, are those the equity splits that will come once the property is sold at the end?
Yes.
And is it also after the investor gets their 8% return, everything on top of that gets split 70-30, or is that something different?
It's upon disposition of the property.
Okay.
Because when the internal rate of return is zero until the investors get their money back.
Yeah.
And it's not likely all capital will be returned until the disposition of the property or some incredible refinance. An example is a 250 units that we bought 16 months ago. We just did a refinance on that last month, so 15 months later, and we returned 36.5% of investor equity okay. they invested in the deal. So in total, with including preferred returns and that deal, we've returned almost 50% of investor equity, and it's been 16 months. And that's a phenomenal deal for investors, but it's still not 100% of their money. So most likely, the return of capital, 100% of capital, will be on disposition or the sale
okay.
of a property. Okay. Therefore, the hurdles will take place on the sale of the property if they're tied to internal rate of returns.
So let's say the property cash flows, let's say 10%. What happens to that 2% difference? Or what does that go to?
If it's 70-30, then 70 cents of the 2%
so I thought.
Go to limited partners, and 30 cents of the 2% go to general partnership.
Okay, totally makes sense. So I guess it looks like we addressed his question about equity percentages. Do you want to go into the other types of syndication fees? Do you want to touch on that?
Yeah, I talked about acquisition fee. There's a lot of different types of fees that can be charged, but you got to use common sense, and you've got to make sure that the investment is very, very profitable for the limited partners, your investors,
yep.
first and foremost. So I will say another type of fee will be asset management fee. And I've seen a couple different ways it's charged. We do 2% of total income on a monthly basis that comes into the property. So if it is $100,000 in collected income for that month, then the asset management fee for that month would be $2,000. I've seen other operators charge $250 per unit per year, which I'm not a fan of because it doesn't have an alignment of interest mm-hmm. with investors or the project. Because regardless of the performance of the project, they're still charging their $250 per unit per year. Whereas when you are compensated based on the performance of the project and the income that comes in, then there's alignment.
Yeah.
Those are the three main ones: equity in the deal, asset management, acquisition, and if you have a loan guarantor, then a loan guarantee fee, and we talked about that. If you own your own property management company, then certainly having a property management fee included, whatever the market rate is, depending on the size of the property, it could be anywhere between 3% if it's 500 unit portfolio, or maybe 6-7% if it's a smaller building, or maybe even 8% if it's 8 unit or something. I know with my single family homes, I pay 8% property management fee. With our apartment communities, we pay 4% in mm-hmm. most cases, 4-4.5% in most cases. On top of that, if you have a construction company, which you likely will if you have a property management company, then you can charge a fee, and you should charge a fee for the construction oversight and overseeing the turnovers of the units, the renovations, the construction projects. We don't charge for that because we have a third-party property management company, but they do have a built-in cost. So it is a pass-through cost, but we don't make any money on that. We work with third-party management companies. Those are the main ways: the acquisition, asset management, having equity in the deal, loan guarantee, if there is one, to your loan guarantee partner, as well as if you have a property management company, then there's 4-8% fee, and then a construction oversight fee, which varies depending on the group.
Yeah, it seems like it's important to take these fees into account when you're actually running the numbers, because you said you don't want to get kind of carried away with these fees. That's something that will negatively affect the limited partners. And so we got to make sure that they're taken care of first before you start kind of collecting the fees for yourself. Does that make sense?
It really is. It's running a business and knowing that everybody needs to make money, especially your clients. Just like every successful company in the world, they deliver more value than they receive. You deliver more value to your customer, and in this case, multifamily syndication, then they're going to want to continue. They're going to give you referrals. They're going to talk to more people. And then the more and more deals you do, your network and your net worth exponentially grows.
Cool. So yeah, there's his question. He said, thanks in advance. Talked about how you subscribe to our podcast. He's going to listen to all 900 episodes. That's going to be a good endeavor.
Get after it, Tim.
So yeah, he said he hasn't been able to find answers to these questions, so they are.
All right. Well, best ever listeners, hope you enjoyed the show. If you haven't signed up for the best ever conference, go do it. We want to see you in Denver, Colorado. Or at least go watch the hip-hop videos at besteverconference.com, and you will enjoy and be entertained by those videos. I can promise you that. Hope to see you there February 24th and 25th. And if you like what you heard, then make sure you're subscribing to the podcast. And if you're watching it, then make sure you're subscribing to either the YouTube channel or the Facebook page. Hope you have a best ever day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Remember to get your free deal analysis tool for your flips at fundthatflip.com/best ever. That's fundthatflip.com/best ever. It will detail your scope of work, help you analyze if the project's profitable, and make a determination on the max purchase price. fundthatflip.com/best ever. Best ever listeners, it is here. Well, it's almost here. February 24th and 25th. The conference, the best ever conference. Have you signed up yet? Oh, if you haven't, you better sign up right now. It's going to sell out. besteverconference.com. I'm going to be there. A bunch of the guests who you've heard interviewed on the show are going to be there. Just go to besteverconference.com and look at all the speakers that you're going to hear from that will help you move your business forward in 2017. I want to meet you in person. The best ever guests who are speaking at this event want to meet you in person. And people who haven't been interviewed on this podcast who are speaking at the conference, they want to meet you in person. Go to besteverconference.com.